Hello and welcome to the Greg Fearon podcast with your host, Greg Fearon. And today I have a special guest who I've been meaning to get on this podcast for a long, long time. Jen Curtis, fat loss coach. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I've been hunting you down for ages and we've made it happen. So I'm really pleased. So give the ladies a bit of a background into you and who you are and what you do.
Like a bit of a background to my career and stuff.
So
I started out life as a linguist. I actually trained in languages at university, spent a few years trying to work in that and realizing I absolutely hated it. There was nothing I wanted to do. So I went back to the drawing board, assessed a lot of things in my life. And about 10 years ago, I just decided to do a course to become a personal trainer, mainly out of personal interest. I had sort of started to get fit myself after I had sort of put on weight after university and like a lot of the drinking weight and stuff like that. And fitness felt like something that really like, you know, brought a lot of other areas of my life into place and sort of had a lot of positive carryover. So I just decided to study it for my own interest, just to know some more about it, because it felt like what a lot of people were saying, like the gym instructors and online sounded like a lot of rubbish. So I wanted to know it for myself. And then just one thing led to another. I got a job and then I got another job and just never left, kept learning. About 5 years ago, I trained to be a nutrition coach, which is obviously a bit of a nebulous term, but like decided to sort of specialize a bit more in understand a bit more about nutrition and fat loss and how it all works and how it all comes together. And so I'm really somebody who's like worked her way up from the gym floor, like just, I guess I was really fascinated on just not just the training part of it, but like how it actually fits into people's lives and how people's minds work and what's going on with them around it. Just before COVID happened, I went online and made a course for postpartum recovery and building strength. And then just after my second was born, so almost 2 years ago now, I did a business course for trainers to learn how to set up a profitable and effective online coaching service. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing that ever since, where I really get to sort of like work closely with people and help them towards their goals. And I always say like the nutrition and the training part is actually really simple. It's like the vast, that people are complex, and figuring out the psychology of it and helping people with their barriers, both real and imagined, is that's kind of my jam these days.
Awesome. So we fit like a glove, because the same as you, right? You know, squats are squats, but yeah, they people are complex.
Yeah. Well, a squat's a squat, but also a lot of trainers fucking butcher it. Like, and you see people who even people who are lifting pretty heavy weights are doing like half range of motion squats and doing it wrong. And it's like, just learn how to do a squat properly and then you've got it for the rest of your life. Like, it takes 10 minutes to learn and maybe a few weeks to perfect, but then you don't have to. There's so many, trainers don't even seem to know how to do these things right.
Well, I think this is, and we were talking about this earlier, was the rise of the internet and information, because it feels like the internet's given people or anybody the information or the permission to come out and just talk about nutrition and training. Like, anybody can do it now.
Oh, yeah.
Qualified or not.
Yeah. And have you ever heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect?
Oh, yes. But I think the listeners would love to hear this one. So shoot.
So the Dunning-Kruger effect is an observation whereby a person's competence in a particular topic is indirectly correlated with their confidence. So the less you know about something, the more confidence you have about that topic. And, you know, you see this when you're like, you know, fresh trainers that have finished their qualification 5 minutes ago. They know everything, right? They know more than people who've been in the field for 10, 20 years. But as you learn more, you realize you know so little and your confidence goes down. And it takes about 10 years for it to even out, and you sort of, your competence and confidence are more evenly aligned. But what ends up happening is then you have just a situation where so many people online don't know what the fuck they're talking about, but like feel very confident and just talk shit and confuse the fuck out of everyone. You said I was allowed to swear, but I've already dropped.
No, keep going. It's all good. We're all adults here. I think you said it perfectly. Like, there's been times when I've questioned my own knowledge of doing this for 20 odd years because I've seen someone on the internet who I've never heard of. And I'm like, going, is that right? And it's crazy, right? But because people deliver information with such confidence, people believe all sorts of BS about losing fat, don't they?
They really do. And there's a lot of misinformation out there. I often say it's like the internet's a bit like TK Maxx. Like, you got to get through a lot of shit to find something good.
I love that. So tell me about some of the most or the biggest bits of misinformation that really get your goat.
I think, like, in the context of like the sort of people that I work primarily with mums, right? It's just that like they seem to believe that like if it's harder work, it's going to get better results. Like, things need to be complicated. And you see it with like, so like, I don't know, the example I always give is like, you get these like yummy mummies on Instagram, right? That are like, you know, just all they do is like their entire life is revolved around cooking and, you know, cooking for their family, cooking for themselves and nutrition and stuff like that. And they will just like, they make it look like every meal has to be this like Pinterest worthy, like, you know, salad, this beautiful like display. And so many mums are just like, oh, I can't keep up with that. I don't have an hour to prepare a meal four times a day. And it's like, you just like, and that one of the things I always used to be struck by is how many mums would ask me, like, I need some meal ideas. And it's like, you don't need meal ideas. Like, what about a sandwich? What about spaghetti bolognese? What about just having fruit and a yogurt for breakfast and a slice of toast, right? Just understand how many calories is in it. Just understand, you know, how it fits your needs. Just make sure it's a balanced meal. But you can have these incredibly simple foods that take 3 minutes to prepare. And they're like, oh, I never thought about that. Like, you never thought about just having a pot of yogurt. Like, it's like, they feel like it has to be, you know, this really complicated, elaborate thing. And it can be like, it can be so simple. You can eat such simple foods, and the foods that you like to eat can often fit into your calorie goals and into a nutritious diet. You don't have to completely overhaul your diet. And that's one of the main ones.
And that's such a good point. Like, even I find sometimes in my clients sharing food, they won't post it or share it. We've got like a Slack community. They won't share it because it looks ugly. I'm like, this is not MasterChef.
It's funny because, like, it's funny that you say that because three years ago, something like that, I started sharing my really simple meals, like a sandwich, like a slice of toast, like really simple stuff, started sharing it on Instagram. And everyone's like, oh, can we have more meal ideas? Can we have more meal ideas? So there's sort of like, all right, I put together a PDF of just like really simple stuff, that all the pictures I had collected of just my, you know, crappy simple meals. And a lot of people, the feedback that I got is it sort of gives them permission to eat just like a tuna sandwich and know that they can lose weight doing that and or maintain their weight, whatever. And I recently sent my, I had this sort of PDF put together that was really shit that I did with all my pictures. And I sent it to a graphic designer. Didn't give him clear enough instructions. He sent me back a really nice thing, but he also replaced all my ugly pictures with really pretty pictures. You know, everything like looks like, you know, Pinterest ready, Instagram ready. And I was like, no, put the ugly pictures back. And he's like, are you sure? I was like, yes, like, this is not going to resonate at all. I need the ugly, simple pictures with like the shadow of my hand on it. Like,
exactly. Cracked me up. My breakfast this morning was seriously messy. I'm going to share that with my clients today. And just be like, hey, look, it doesn't have to be, you know, MasterChef, the Ivy for it to get results. That's awesome. So
100%.
You said something really interesting. You said the word calories.
No, right? Sacrilege.
How dare you say calories? Because fat loss is so much more complex, and calories don't matter, right? Isn't that what we're being told at the minute?
Yeah, so this is obviously like I this is one of the biggest myths, right? And one of the things I was going to say is just like this idea that calories don't matter, or it's like old-fashioned to think about calories. And there's like the narrative today is all sort of like, oh, it's about eating clean food, or it's about eating like cutting out like seed oils or whatever, like, you know, the thing at the sort of enemy of the state today, like is today. And it's all about gut health, right? And things like that. And it's like rather than calories. And I think people have this like this false dichotomy in their minds that either it's all about eating healthy foods or it's just about calories. And they kind of have this if it fits your macros kind of concept of it. Going, you can eat crap, it doesn't matter as long as it fits in your calories. And it's like one of the things I say a lot online is two different things can be true at the same time. Like calories matter and healthy eating, healthy food matters, right? Like for different reasons, and eating healthily plays into also helps with fat loss for a multitude of reasons. But if you want to lose weight, which is most people's goal, that you have to be eating, you have to be ingesting less energy than you are expending. There's no way around the thermodynamics of it. And yeah, so many people have this false dichotomy in their mind.
But what about hormones? Because there's so many people online at this minute in time going, there are conditions such as PCOS, insulin resistance is the latest one that seems to crop up a lot, that those will stop you from losing weight. So.
Like I always think it's funny how people ask about hormones though, because so you'll be talking to a client about the fact that like, they're just consuming too many calories, whatever, and they'll say, well, what about hormones? You're like, well, what about hormones? And they're like, maybe I can't lose weight because of hormones. And it's like, hormones govern literally every process in the body, like as in, it's kind of like saying, well, maybe it's because I'm a human. Like, as in, there's a lot of things that go into being a human. Do you know what I mean? It's just so vague. Like, which hormones, what processes are they affecting? And they'll say, like, I don't know, cortisol is one,
Oh.
right? And it's like, I think what people don't understand is that, like, cortisol isn't bad, right? Like, cortisol, you need cortisol. Like, if you don't have cortisol, you literally die, right? And there's a range of, like, good levels of cortisol, right, for each individual, and then too much is not good, and too bad, too little is not good, and it's the same for every other hormone. I feel like a lot of people didn't hear the Goldilocks and the Three Bears stories growing up. Like, it's like you need there's a range that is healthy, just like there's a range of body fat percentage that's healthy, right? It's not on spot, or like, there's a certain amount of each vitamin that's healthy. Too much, too little is not good for you. Like broccoli is healthy, but you eat too much of it, you're going to be pissing out your ass for 4 days. Like, if you drink too much water, you will literally die. It's like there's a range of, like, it's not just either good or bad. And hormones is one of those things that people conceptualize as like good or bad, or they sort of go, well, what about hormones? And it's like, be specific, like, which ones, when? How much?
It's so funny because I used to work in the NHS and I used to run an endocrinology department.
Oh, yeah.
The doctors, one of the diabetes and doctors used to send his patients to me when they couldn't lose weight. And
Oh, yeah.
I'd be like, "Doc, they're eating too much." He's like, "Oh, like yeah, they're eating too much." So I
Yeah.
think is it though that hormones, because it means it's not my fault. Because I think calories, I think what happens with especially for women generally, is that when they hear the word calories, they start to think, well, it's my fault. I'm a bad person. So if it's not about calories, then it's about hormones. then I can't do anything about it and it's not my fault. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I think, you know, also like the right mindset is like, okay, like, so yes, there are definitely people who think that way. Like, oh, if I blame this or if this is the cause, then there's nothing I can do about it. It's not my fault. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. But like, then it also means that you can't do anything about it and you can't change it. Whereas I think like when people have the right mindset about these things, they'll go, okay, so it's about calories and I can reduce like my calorie intake and I can figure out how to do that. And there are certain strategies. I don't need to make this up myself. There are like certain strategies for doing that, certain things that work, certain things you can try. And then like, I can have a, like, that's empowering. Like, I think most women that I work with, they go through that process of realizing it's not about shaming and blaming, right? It's about taking responsibility. It's like personal responsibility. Like, I like, nobody's coming to help you. Like, this isn't going to change like on its own. You can't like, you know, Hail Mary approach, just like hope this into existence. Like, you can't manifest this with like post-it notes on your mirror go like, I'm a goddess, I am already thin, I am already the size I want to be, you know, like women love that kind of thing. You actually have to like assess the situation, figure out what's not working, make changes that work for you and that help you reach towards your goals. And most women that I work with find that process actually incredibly empowering, learning that what they can do to change something that's deeply important to them and that's deeply troubling them in their life.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm seeing like a rise in, my clients are awesome as well. They're cool. Like, if they are empowered people. I think that's a really key one. I think what I'm finding is where we see TikTok and Instagram, it's almost giving power to not having empowerment. I know that sounds like a weird saying, but it's almost like, well, it's all about hormones and us women go through all of these things. And like, yes, we get it. We know that a woman's life is hard. Like, look, you're in your third pregnancy, which I'm going to come to later, which is going to be awesome when I talk about training. But we know that hormonal stuff has a real big impact on women. But it's almost like it's used as a, well, this can't work because of this one thing. And I think you're right. It's about empowerment and how you take that message.
Definitely. And it's interesting what you say that like hormones can really affect women, right? Because like, yes, we're like women have like certain challenges, and I like all what I said doesn't negate the fact that certain women have like more challenges than other women. So if you've got PCOS, if you've got endometriosis, if you're going through menopause, you certainly have a different collection of issues or challenges that women who don't have those things. If you're postpartum or pregnant, you have a collection of it, like barriers in your way that other women don't have. But again, two different things can be true at the same time. You can also have certain things in your way. You know, I have, I don't want to go into details, but I have underlying health condition that also affects many areas of my life. But it doesn't change the fact that it might not be my fault. I don't have to feel bad about it, but it's still my responsibility. I'm the only one that's going to change it. But I also find it interesting that it's like, you know, women have this particular problem. So I always thought that as well. And I listened to a podcast the other day that really just said something that really stuck with me, that she said, you know, we often talk about the unpredictability of like women's cycles and like changes throughout the lifespan and stuff like that. But there is a certain predictability to it. There's a certain pattern to it that women are more this or more emotional or more this at certain times of the month or certain points in their life phase. Whereas a man, his testosterone levels are affected by how many women are in the room, how many fertile women are in the room, if there's a gun in the room, if someone's fighting. Like, I mean, men's testosterone and hormonal levels are affected much less predictably than women's. So I think it's just like, just an interesting perspective on it that I hadn't thought about.
That's a great perspective. Do you know what? I've never thought about it too. I've never thought about it. There's probably ways that I react when different people are in the room or when there's threats and stuff. So yeah, that makes total sense. Total
I think
sick.
there's a lot of focus on like women's issues today, but men's issues are also very interesting, and we kind of just turn a blind eye to it.
Yeah, I think it's just because like I generally work, I think 99.9% of my clients are women. And I guess the audience that listens to this is generally women. But yeah, you're right. I think us men go through our own issues in regards to fat loss and gaining muscle, et cetera, nutrition, doesn't mean we don't have problems.
Yeah, and I've always worked with men as well. I mean, I worked earlier on in my career, it was about 50-50. I worked at a CrossFit gym, so I was, yeah, like if you think men, I always just say to women who are like, oh, women have these body issues and women have these problems and that problems. I'm like, you just don't know about men's issues. Like, as in, work for 5 minutes in a gym that's mainly men, and you see they all have body image issues, they all have their own shit. Just like we do, it's just different, or they're a bit less open about it.
Yeah, we just don't talk about it. We talk about it on a very quiet scale. We don't kind of, it's very rare for a man to come out on the internet and say, hey, do you know what? I've really suffered with my body image. It won't happen.
Yeah.
We talk about it to friends, but we won't be out on the internet saying, oh yeah, I looked in the mirror and I really struggled with what I see in front of me. It just won't happen because we're not conditioned to do that.
And I've worked closely with a lot of men, and it can be something that deeply affects their confidence and their, you know, and their life. And it's very hard for them to talk about, and it's almost a taboo for them to talk about as well.
Yeah, I can't ever imagine me at any point going out on the internet and saying that, because you'd almost feel like other men would be like, what's going on with you? Like, we don't talk about that stuff. Pipe down.
Yeah.
But we should talk about it for sure. We should talk about it, and we just don't.
Yeah, we should. Yeah. At least recognize it that like it's going on for men as well.
Maybe that's a part two we can.
Yeah.
We can do one day. I think that sounds like a very interesting topic. So,
Yeah.
you're, as you said, third pregnancy. I know you're still training. How can you train while you're pregnant?
Is this a thing that people still think? Like, do people still think that you shouldn't work out when you're pregnant?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it happens. People, I think there's this, there's lots of myths and fallacies that kind of just hang around in the ether, you know, a little bit like carbs make you fat, right? We know there's so much science out there about it, but we know it still kind of just appears.
Yeah, it's like the these sort of beliefs that people still are sort of ingrained. It's funny because it's a lot of like what our grandmothers have sort of told us. And I don't know about you, but my grandmother doesn't know an awful lot about an awful lot. So like, it's funny how we sort of trust their sort of opinions on it. But yeah, like it's interesting the evolution of like. Of pregnancy exercise, because you know, if you go back like 100 years or so, it was considered, well, most people were didn't do exercise. It was considered as like, you know, it wasn't it was like you want to rest as much as possible. And we were much more physically active, and people didn't want to like, you know, wear themselves out or wear their joints out. My dad still thinks like that today. I always tell him you're going to rust out before you wear yourself out. Like he's sort of very worried about wearing his knees out. He doesn't realize that, you know, you've got to give it some like input to build cartilage or bone
Yeah.
density or whatever. But yeah, like, you know, 100 years ago, it was sort of considered, you know, women shouldn't exercise, that like it was bad for women, or it shouldn't run fast or lift anything heavy. And then we sort of got over that a bit, but then it was still pregnancy, you know, don't lift anything, don't do anything. And each year they like there's like guidelines released on prenatal exercise, and it gets more and more permissive every single year. And you know, like the most recent stuff is very permissive. It's like a kind and really quite vague. It's like hey, just do you should be doing cardiovascular exercise, you should be raising your heart rate, you should also be doing resistance training twice a week. They're not very specific on how much you should lift and things like that, but you know, for the most part, lifting even heavyweights doesn't have and like negative outcomes for pregnancy. It can, lifting too heavy can have negative outcomes for the mother in terms of like pelvic floor dysfunction, because it's a pressure system, like your core, and want to respect that and train within its limits. But it's incredibly important for women to train through that phase of their life and maintain bone density, maintain muscle mass, maintain cardiovascular fitness, for mental health as well. So yeah, it's very safe and actually has a lot more benefits than it does risks.
And you said something really interesting there, that heavy lifting might have an impact for the woman, obviously pelvic floor function, all that stuff. But if I lift too heavy too, I can have impacts too. So I think the thread we're kind of seeing here is that similar things will affect people in almost very similar ways if you do too much of it, if you don't do enough of it. It kind of, there's no, it's like I said to someone the other day, there's no menopause diet. They're like, of course there is. No, there isn't. Like, we're all humans, we all eat the same food. Kind of thing.
Yeah, like I made a post about menopause recently, sort of saying, yeah, I'm not an expert on this, but what I do know is that guidelines for maintaining your weight and fitness during menopause are much more similar than they are different to maintaining your weight, being healthy, and maintaining your fitness in other parts of your life, like in other chapters of your life. It's much more similar than it is different. It's just the basics, right? Of getting the right nutrition, getting the right calorie intake for your metabolic needs, doing some resistance training, doing some cardiovascular training, getting enough fiber. Like, it's very basic things, really. And getting enough sleep, stress management, like these absolute basics. You know, I always love it when people are like, yeah, I have a friend, for example, who sleeps terribly, is incredibly stressed. She gets about 4 hours sleep a night. And she's always, every week she's like doing blood tests. And she's like, oh, maybe it's because I don't have enough of this in my diet, or maybe it's because of that. And it's like, expression I love is, if you hear hooves, think horses, not unicorns. If you're only sleeping 4 hours a night and you're stressed out of your mind, maybe that's why your digestion is shit, not because you need to cut out gluten. Like, maybe that's why, like, I don't know, you feel crap or you feel down.
Mm.
And it's, I think it's the same for sort of menopause or pregnancy or whatever else.
Yeah, there is this thing where people tend to look for something else rather than the thing that's right in front of them.
Yeah.
What do you think drives that?
I think people tend to avoid, I think we have a bias towards things that sound sort of sexy and exciting and new. It's much more interesting to have this sort of novel explanation about your hormones or your gut health than it is to just recognize, okay, I'm not sleeping enough, I'm not exercising enough, I'm overweight, I eat a lot of crap. Like, maybe, like, and people have this kind of like, they don't want to focus on those basic things. It kind of feels too basic. Like, they need something more exciting. But you see it, like, a lot of my work is like, you know, when I onboard somebody, it's just simplifying it, just sort of getting them to see the horses and not imagine the unicorns. It just kind of like focus on the basics. But the self-deception is very, very high. And people throughout the process will like, you know, just a client comes to mind where it's like, she's just eating too many calories. But every week she tries to sort of go, oh, maybe it's because I'm not eating enough, or maybe it's because I'm not working out enough, or maybe it's because, like, she tries to find other reasons. And it's because she doesn't want to do that thing. So it's like the obstacle is the way. Do you know what I mean? It's like sometimes the thing that you don't want to face, it's the same in like therapy or psychology. The thing you don't want to face is the thing that you avoid, and you focus on other things.
Yeah.
It's painful.
Pardon?
Because it's painful. It's hard to do that thing that you don't want to do.
Yeah, because it's almost your ego saying, look, this is what you haven't been doing, or you've done this wrong, or you haven't been looking after this bit. So your ego gets impacted, I think, a lot with that. It's when I say to people, you know, oh, Greg, I think my hormones are a problem. Like, tell me about your nutrition. Would you be willing to track your food for 4 days over a weekend, including a weekend? And they're like, oh, I don't want to track calories. No. But why not? And that's it's a simple thing, but like you say, but it's a very well-intentioned conversation because we have to start somewhere, right?
Yeah. So I find by the time someone gets to working with me, like they have already drunk the Kool-Aid, they get that calories also matter, right? I have a thick filter on my like social media. I'm pretty clear about that being important as well. Like not being the only thing, but being important as well. And they come into it sort of going, yeah, okay, I'm ready to do this. But you do, I have, especially more like earlier on, or people who haven't gone through that thick filter as much, there's much more resistance to tracking calories. And I think it's like this thing that's become demonized, like that it's only something that people who are obsessed, it leads to, I think there's a lot of myths as well, to be fair. Like people sort of say things like tracking calories leads to disordered eating. And it's like, no, it doesn't. That is so, like, that's such a reductive way of thinking about eating disorders. Normally, I don't know if you have worked with people with eating disorders, had eating disorders or anything like that. But I've got quite sort of like, you know, intimate knowledge of eating disorders. And eating disorders are caused by deep psychological distress and like shit, really like, you know, hard shit going on in your life. And it's a way of coping, it's a coping mechanism for that. Just the way that emotional eating is also like, you know, a coping mechanism for shit in your life that, you know, you're numbing it or distracting yourself from it or whatever. Like eating disorders aren't like sometimes people who have eating disorders track calories obsessively, but it's cause and effect here. Like the tracking doesn't cause the eating disorder. It's often a symptom of the eating disorder.
Yeah, if I could high five you right now, I would. But yeah, high five.
F five.
Because yeah, for me with eating disorders, you know, generally I'll refer out with those kind of ladies. However, you know, I had an ex who had an eating disorder, and you know, we talked about tracking food once many years ago, and the tracking she was doing at the time was a trigger. But the issues that caused the eating disorder were not MyFitnessPal. Hell no. Hell no.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, I'm not saying someone with an eating disorder should track calories, right? Like, again, people like jump to things and say, oh, so you're saying, like,
Yeah, I know you're just like, seriously, that's not what I said. You've made up a whole different sentence.
yeah, I said words and you just heard something totally different. So I'm not saying that, right? And I'm not saying it's even something that would help with eating disorders. And I don't work with people with eating disorders, right? If you've got a full-blown eating disorder, like I'm not, it's not like I'm not, it's out of my pay grade, right? Like it's above my pay grade. But I do believe that while very few people have actual eating disorders, most people do have disordered eating. It's kind of like spectrum, right? And so actually what I found is that tracking for a period of time can actually help with disordered eating because you understand, okay, so my calorie needs are 2000 calories a day. That's what I need to eat in order to maintain my weight. If I want to be in a calorie deficit, I need to eat like, or if I want to lose, you know, a decent amount of weight at a decent pace, I need to be in roughly a 20% deficit. So I need to eat around 1600 calories a day. And it helps. I often have women who are like, oh, I had a bagel for lunch. Like, it must be so high in calories. Like, I've probably totally blown my diet. And you're like, you actually go through the different elements of it. It's like a 500 calorie bagel. It's like, oh, that's a totally reasonable lunch. Like, there's no need to spiral about that. It's like, I find that often women, but and men, I just work more with women, but they will spiral and catastrophize about things that are their imagination. And when you present them with the facts, like a big part of fat loss is like seeing things clearly and not like catastrophizing things, but also not seeing things overly positive, right? Because if you're one of these people who's like, oh yeah, it's fine that I just ate a whole thing of Oreos, it's fine that I just ate, you know, a whole thing, like, it's okay, I can, like, I shouldn't restrict myself, da, 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 da. It's like, you know, that's also like seeing things too positively, right? Like, you kind of need to reel that in. But there's, again, there's that range that's like healthy in between. And like, yeah, understanding the facts and understanding like the calories that's in something leaves a lot less to your imagination, like, because your imagination fills in the gaps with like worst case scenarios, right? So just understanding how many calories is in things can often really help people have a much better relationship with food, and realizing that it fits into their calorie total and that it's really not as bad as they think.
Yeah. Oh, do you know what? I've just made up a saying that you just inspired me with, and it's data over drama.
Oh yeah, big time. Like, facts over feelings. Like, and I do think that's something that women struggle with more than men, is it's a lot about how they feel. Like, I feel like I ate too much. I feel like I won't lose weight eating this many calories. I feel like I'm not working out enough, that I should be working out more. And it's like, it doesn't really matter. Like, I had this Russian coach that was a bit of a mentor when I was working at CrossFit like 10 years ago, this guy called Pavel. And he was always like, your feelings don't matter. Like, it's not about your feelings. It's not about how you feel. Like, I feel like this isn't enough volume for my shoulders. It doesn't matter about how you're feeling. It's like about, like, there's things that are like facts that you can go by. And I think a lot of women need to learn, especially with fat loss, to like, trust their feelings more. And that's where like all intuitive eating, right, is like, that's another one. Like, that's where that's become so popular among women, because it allows them to, it kind of validates their feelings, even if their feelings are completely wrong, because it's all about your intuition. Like, there's no facts on the ground and data about food. It's just how you feel about what you're eating that matters. And it's like, well, okay, fine, it does, if like you just want to, you know, whatever, like, you don't have any actual objective goals, like losing weight or getting fit or anything. But if you actually want to reach a certain goal, like, your feelings aren't all that matters.
And I know many people who track their bank account every 20 minutes, but won't track food.
Yeah, and it's the same thing.
I'm like, and I don't very rarely say that what you put into your body is going to be more important than your bank account, really. Like, when you really think about it, you know, that's feeding your life force, you know. So here's a really controversial question for you. Can you be healthy at any size?
Oh, I get myself like cancelled for this.
Oh, well. We'll be all right. We'll be fine.
So I think that like healthy at any size is like, I think we have increasingly a culture today where like we tell people like what they, we kind of, we're kind to be cruel. It's like, we kind of try to tell people what makes them feel warm and fuzzy and try to protect them from the harsh reality of life. And there's so many examples of this, and healthy at every size, and the whole fat acceptance movement and the body positivity stuff. I think it just really, really is like, you know, a great example of that, of telling people, sort of like saying, okay, I don't want to upset this person, so I'm going to tell them exactly what they think. I think there's a lot of like women in particular saying, like, doing a lot of work and mental gymnastics to tell themselves that they're beautiful and attractive when they're not, when they're like objectively not. And it's like, you can, it's hard work to convince yourself that, but it's also hard work to lose weight, like pick your hard kind of thing. But not only that, but also very, some of them are very aggressively telling other people what is attractive and beautiful and healthy. And you know, like, I think, you know, it's that sort of make Instagram or TikTok videos saying like, you know, you will find me attractive, you must find me attractive, like, this is like, fat is beautiful, this is beautiful. And like, you can't tell other people what's attractive, what they're allowed to like find attractive. And I often get pushback on that, and people say, well, we have these arbitrary beauty standards. And my argument is that our beauty standards are anything but arbitrary. Like what, that like the holy trinity of beauty is health, fertility, and youth, right? These are objectively desirable attributes. And when you, if you have them, you have them. And if you don't have them, like it sucks. Like I'm, you know, I'm 35 now. I'm not that old, but like, I'm also not 25 anymore. And it hurts a little bit that like, you know, you have the gray hairs or the wrinkles or whatever, but it's, or the stretched skin. Yeah, that's something to do. And yeah, I'd love, you know, I'd love to be still, you know, as objectively like whatever as I was when I was 25, but it's just the harsh reality of life, isn't it? And there are certain parts of that that we can't control and certain parts that we can. But yeah, it's like being overweight is an independent risk factor for every single chronic disease going.
Yeah. I think it was funny. I put a post talking about this on LinkedIn the other day and someone was like, well, these Western beauty standards need to go. And I just replied back saying, listen, in the UK, Black Afro-Caribbean women have the highest proportion of obesity and diabetes. How is that beautiful? Like, how is that a beautiful thing? They're dying early. They're on medications for life. How is that a beautiful thing? That's crazy. No.
It's funny that knee-jerk reaction, isn't it? Like these Western beauty standards, like there's this war on anything Western that's like...
Yeah, but that must mean that everything Eastern is also perfect.
Yeah, again, a false dichotomy that's like everything that's not Western, part of like what we consider to be the West, is like good. And everything that is Western is bad.
Yeah, it's you know, to, in China, they used to tie their feet up, didn't they, to make them really
small.
So do you know what?
Like foot binding.
Yeah. So all you Western women, for your beauty standards, we now need to adopt these Eastern standards and tie feet. Just know you wouldn't do that. So
yeah.
So is it then more about, there's a book I'm reading. I've never totally forgotten what it's called. Brilliant. But it was just talking about how beliefs are very difficult to change with data. So if you say to me, I don't know, I believe the sky is blue, and I present you some statistics that tell you actually 70% of the light in the sky is blue or black, so I'll say, you'll be like, no, my belief is that. Is that probably maybe the bigger thing, that we defend our beliefs and our ego over data?
Well, one thing that I've learned about Instagram and the internet, like when I started out, you know, sharing on Instagram, is that I really felt like I was there to try and change people's minds and convince people of like what is true. And like the, you know, okay, so for example, busting the myth that carbs are bad for you and getting people to believe that carbs are good for you. And I've realized that it's much more fruitful to just connect with like-minded people and share information that realize that some people are going to really connect to your way of looking at things, and to try and connect with those people, that it kind of further confirms their like beliefs or things that they want to believe. And that sounds quite, you know, like there's a bad side of that as well, because then we all are in these like echo chambers. It's very hard to reach out of your echo chambers. It's very hard to reach into the vegan community and explain to them why it's really important to eat red meat. You know, like it's not going to work. It's very hard for me to reach into the body positivity community and explain why they're wrong. But there's a whole bunch of people who are, you know, who have sort of seen all this body positivity stuff or seen stuff about carbs. They feel like that doesn't sound quite right, but I don't have all the information I need to like put it together. I haven't heard an alternative narrative. So then when you put together a coherent alternative narrative that is like, that's it, that's what I was thinking, that's like, that's a lot easier to do on the internet than trying to convince people that they're wrong.
I think our job is almost a bit of a vocation. It feels like we want to try and help everybody. Like everybody who's injured and dying on the street, we want to help everybody. And I think you're right. Well, we spend hours and years giving out information that people will read and go, well, no, I believe that. So you can only help those who are ready to change or believe you know, very similar to you. So it makes total sense. So I've got two bits left.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to need a part two because I'm enjoying this far too much.
Me too.
One of my questions, so if a client comes to you and they've been working with you for, say, let's, you know, a while, and they're not losing body fat, how do you get them over that plateau? Because that's a big question that always comes up.
Wait, if they've been working with me for a while and they're not losing body fat?
Yeah, so, you know, they were doing all right for a while, and then they've kind of stalled for 3-4 weeks, and they're like, I'm doing everything. Where do you look? Where do you do? Where do you go with them?
So one of the first, the first thing I visit, let's say they've been losing weight and then they've stalled, right? One of the first things I say is, normally at the same time, you'll hear little things about like feeling less motivated and like da da da. And so, you know, my spiel is like, welcome to the valley of disappointment. This is a natural part. You know, if you start out on this process, it's all novel, it's all exciting, you're doing something new. Within 2 to 4 weeks, people enter the valley of disappointment where motivation wanes. It's not so exciting anymore. The reality of what you need to do on a day-to-day basis to lose fat is very quickly becomes apparent that you're not doing anything extreme. Right? When you're doing it my way, it's very unglamorous. It's very slow and steady. There's tangible weight loss every week if we're doing it right, but it's not this really exciting, you know, lose 10 pounds in 10 days kind of thing. And so people enter the valley of disappointment, and my job is to get them through the valley of disappointment. So motivation's over here, and then it tanks to here. And my goal is to get it to here, right? Where like, it's not going back to those previous levels of like kind of manic excitement about it. Cause people confuse motivation with enthusiasm. And that initial burst of energy at the beginning is not sustainable motivation. I don't want to take them back there. My job isn't to be a Mr. Motivator, like kind of thing. So just to bring them into what I then cheesily call like the planes of consistency, just realizing that there's a certain formula that they've figured out by now, how much they need to eat, what kinds of food they need to eat. They've got kind of a meal plan we've put together. They just need to stick to it and they just need to do it. And it's just going to take the time that it takes. Another expression I love is you can't make a baby in 1 month by getting 9 women pregnant. And you can't make a baby in 1 month by getting 9 women pregnant. Right. That is to say, you just can't speed it up. It takes 9 months, right? And with all the technology we have in the world and with the best diet and with the best medicine, you still can't make it take less than 9 months. So it's just going to take the time that it takes to lose the weight and start working more on patience, on being consistent, on realizing that these are habits that you need to change for the rest of your life. You're not just doing a 3-week diet and then going back to what you're doing before, and focusing on the big rocks and just being consistent. That's my first port of call, because it's usually the valley of disappointment that's the reason why people have, like, their fat loss has stalled. They've stopped doing the things that they need to do because they're bored. And like, they want something more exciting now. And that usually works, right? People get it and they're like, okay. Because everyone goes into, what I always think is funny is people come into this fat loss process always thinking that they're so unique. Like all of their problems, like they sort of start telling me their problems going like, well, I don't know how to track meals when I'm eating out, or I don't know what to do. The weekend's so much harder than during the week, or I don't know how to track this certain food, or I tend to want to eat something, like eat too much in the evening, whatever it is. And it's like, I have a member site with videos on all the most, like, say, like the top 20 biggest things that people bring up. And everyone comes into the process and sort of tells me these things as though I've never heard it before. And this is going to be the first time. I've got no idea how to overcome this problem. And they're always in those top 20 things that's on the member site. And they're just like everyone else. And they're not that unique. And I think there's something about that as well, where people sort of feel a bit deflated because they're like, oh, I thought I was so special. And it's not the same problems as everyone else.
Yeah, it wasn't your cortisol, Missy. I promise you that.
Yeah.
And the beautiful thing is that all of these habits, will actually make other parts of their life better. That's the bit that really shocks me every time. People are like, Greg, I'm making more money in my business. I'm like, because you develop these habits and transfer them over to your business. Like, duh.
Yes, but also, if you do fat loss right, you make food and that part of your life much more automated. So you spend much less brain power thinking about it. I can't tell you how many women, especially I work with a lot of sort of women who are high achievers and have, you know, high paid jobs, and they'll sort of plug in the morning, keep working. They'll start getting hungry around 12, but they won't stop to eat. They'll go, no, I've got to keep going. And they keep going for 2 more hours, at which point they're like, fuck, I'm so hungry. And then they go to the fridge and they're looking for like food and they're like, oh, what am I going to eat? And when you're starving hungry, all of your like mental faculties completely go out the window. And then it's, and I always say, like, you can't avoid the decision of what to have for lunch. You can only put it off. And then you're putting it off to the worst time when you're starving hungry and now you're stressed and now your brain isn't working. And then you just start eating biscuits out of the tin. And then you have a packet of crisps. And then you're like, oh no, now I've ruined my diet. And then it just creates so much stress and so much mental fatigue. And then they feel shit because they've eaten shit. Whereas if you stopped at 12 when you started feeling hungry, spent 3 minutes making scrambled eggs on toast, ate it, got back to work, you'd be fine. And you'd be like steaming through the afternoon, well-fueled, ate something healthy, spend a lot less time thinking about food and worrying about food. And then you've got all this extra brain power for like the things that actually matter.
One of the first things I do with those kind of clients is I look at their calendar and I'm like, where's your lunch break? And they're like, oh, it's not in it. And I'm like, okay, now we're going to put a lunch break in. And sometimes, and I've done it before, I've called them and said, hey, what are you doing? Oh, I'm just working. It's your lunch break. Go lunch. And then they get it. They're like, ah, got it. So dream. Love it.
Yeah, it's like the number of people who think that you can just like, oh, I don't have time for lunch, as though it's like, it's just like non-negotiable. Like, you have to eat. Like, it's like saying, oh, I don't have time to go to the toilet during the day. Well, what are you going to do? Your bladder's going to burst. Like, at some point, you have to, like, and they're not making time for it. And my message is also like, you don't have to spend an hour, right? You can spend 3 minutes making food, 10 minutes eating it, and get back to work. But I can't get it down to zero. Right. I can't make, you know, I can't give you like an injection that you can just, you know, stick in your arm and carry on working. Like, it is going to take a chunk of time out of your day. We can get it down to the minimum, but we can't get it down to zero.
Love it. So last piece, because this podcast could go on for hours.
It'd be lots to talk about.
Like an epic podcast. Just talk to us a little bit about emotional eating. I'm going to have to come back for a part two, obviously, but just, what tips would you give someone to start dealing with emotional eating? I've got my thoughts, but I'd love to hear yours.
So, like, my starting point with most of these things is like, and I'm big on like paradigm shifts, because I think the cultural narrative that we often have around these topics is like completely wrong. So I think that the cultural narrative around emotional eating is it kind of boils down to just don't do it. Like, just say no. like the same as to drugs or whatever, like, just say no. And so many women are sort of like, right, I'm going to stop emotional eating. And what I try to tell them is that like, what you've got to understand is emotional eating is not the problem. It's the symptom. It's a symptom of the problem. So you've got to figure out, like, work backwards from the emotional eating. So what kind, like, I always call it non-hunger eating, because I think there's like a bigger, like, emotional eating is one part of that, but there's also boredom eating, there's procrastination eating, there's reward eating, there's like a lot of other elements of it. So figuring out why you're eating, right, in the first place, like, what is that giving you? Is it helping you relax? Is it self-medication? Is it to numb difficult emotions? Is it because you're bored? What is it? And then work backwards from that, like, what do you need? What is food kind of the gap that food's trying to fill that you aren't getting from your life, right? And then start to build those things. So if the problem is that you're stressed out of your mind, you hate your job, you've got relationship issues, like no amount of like manifestations and affirmations or whatever is going to make you feel good about that. You have to go and fix your problems, right? Because we have a very, I think women tend to have a very emotional approach to like your problems or whatever. It's like sometimes it's a practical problem that you need to fix. And then if it's just, you know, like if it's stress or whatever else, it's like, but what are you doing to like manage stress? What are you doing to reduce stress? And, you know, exercise can be really powerful for that. You know, just sorting like losing body fat can be that if your main source of stress in life is that you're, you know, massively overweight and you're worried about your health, like that's the problem that you need to sort out. But also, you know, also what stress management strategies do you have? Because most women just try to take away the emotional eating and then they're just left with all the shitty emotions without anything to kind of help them deal with it. So do you, like, you need to replace it with something. So do you need to exercise? Do you need to go and have a hot, like a hot bath and a glass of wine? Do you need to go and do a face mask, go and get a massage? Like, you need to have some other, like meditation or like yoga nidra or something. You need to have some other strategies for regulating your emotions other than food. And then also like hobbies, the number of women, I guess dads as well, that don't have like hobbies, things that they do just for the pure joy of it, things they did before kids, like playing the guitar, writing, reading. Like you spend 10 minutes doing this, just something that you enjoy for the sake of doing it. So there's a few different like things, but you've got to understand what void it's filling and then replace it with something. Don't just try and take away your only coping mechanism, because you're only gonna, that's not gonna work for more than like 45 minutes.
And that's when you start saying yes to drugs because you said no to emotional eating.
Yeah. Yeah, start smoking instead, that'll help.
Yeah, it's really funny when people track food, especially if they're just being honest with it, you'll see emotional eating always happens on a Wednesday afternoon at 7 o'clock, and you're like, right, so let's work backwards. What happens in the lead up to that? So is it an emotional eat now, or is it been done so long it's now become a habit? And it's so funny, people are like, oh my god. So it might have started out as an emotional eating or boredom or whatever, but you start seeing it become 7 o'clock Wednesday after I've had a meeting with the finance director. It's always really stressful. Yeah. It makes me feel shit about myself. Right, where's those Oreos?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like that habit starts to then creep in, and it's like the thing, you know, the neural pathways are there, so it's the easiest thing to go and do. And doing something else is really hard because you don't have those neural pathways set up. So you've got to set up new habits, the new neural pathways, which feels very clunky in the beginning. Like, what's your take on emotional eating, like, other than that?
I think we share a very similar path. So one of the things I like to call it is story rewriting. So basically, we all have a bunch of stories in our heads about certain situations. And I like to talk to clients and understand what's the story behind the emotional eating. Like, tell me, when did it start? Okay, cool. What was the background? And then often she'll say, oh, actually, I've just realized this is what happened. So for me, my emotional go-to is wine gums. Okay. And I know that the backstory is that when I got some really high praise for football and stuff, my dad used to buy me wine gums when I was younger. Subconsciously, if I'm feeling a bit shitty, I'm like, where's the Maynard's wine gums? And I'm going for a big pack here. I'm not going for a tube. I'm going for a big pack, like 1,000 calories. And that's that. And I tell clients that's what I've noticed I do. So I have to see when I'm feeling fatigued, when things are happening, so I can pick it up before I'm knee deep in black and red wine gums.
Right. Yeah.
It's always about the story that's going through your head at the time when you're doing these things.
There's so many elements to it as well, though, isn't there? Because there's also like one thing that I work with clients on is like, you know, their family's relationship with food, and get them to reflect on how, in particular, their mothers and grandmothers were around food, because a lot of them had, so a lot of us grew up with a lot of like war child syndrome of like, you know, like finish, you've got to finish everything that's on your plate. You know, the world that my grandmother grew up in is very different from the world that I grew up in terms of they never had enough food and we always had far too much of it. And they didn't adapt their thinking to that. And so we grew up with this enormous abundance, but also an insane amount of pressure from parents and grandparents to eat all of it, because they can't switch their mind. And those messages are very powerful. So there's a lot to explore. There's a lot to unpack. And when I come into these situations with a client, I have a lot more questions than answers in the beginning. Is it like, you know, what's triggering the emotional eating? What's like, is it a habit? Like, what are your parents' messaging around food? You know, what are your beliefs around it? Like, there's a lot to unpack and figure out. And I always say sunlight is the best disinfectant. So like, once you start to work through this and point things out to people, they're like, oh wow, yeah, like I didn't realize that was the issue.
Yeah, it's even so my heritage is Jamaican, and food is love. And my mum will say, Greg, you're putting on weight, while she's giving me more curry goat. I'm like, but mum, you just told me I put on weight. But that's love. Food is love. Food is it's how we bond and come together. So, those old narratives, because we bond so much with our parents and what our parents did. Because, you know, 7 years old, I think we pick up so much. We're virtually created as a person by seven. Yes, teenage years can also shape us a lot. But 7 years old, and when people say, you're a bit like your mum, you know, be like, no, I'm not. But that's what you've been around for the last how many years. Of course, you picked up those habits and those mindsets. So it's often a lot deeper than just willpower and discipline, for sure.
And it's complicated, right? Because food does have a big significance in our life. It's not just fuel. It's also there for celebration. It's also there for sharing and connection with other people. It's also there for, like, it is a way of showing love. Like, the way, you know, I cook for my children and for my husband and for my family, and it is a way of meeting their needs. You know, it is an important thing. So it's just like, when it gets, we also need to be able to reflect on it and weed out when it's a healthy relationship, or when it's gone out of that healthy range, and when the connection to it is too strong or too weak, and kind of need to tease those things out, and be able to like use it as like, so you know, socially being able to sit down and break bread with other people and enjoy the meal, but then not have this compulsive nature to it where we're either compulsively feeding people or compulsively eating.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, such a deep topic. So listen, we've had like an hour of your awesomeness. So basically, you got promised me you'll come back and do a part two.
Yeah, sure. Dig into some of these other topics that we touched on.
I'd love to. And maybe talk about training as well, because I think that's a real big topic in of itself.
We've just talked about food pretty much.
But it's such an important part of the whole fat loss conundrum, right? And
it is.
Yeah, the training bit's the other side, and I think we should talk about that. That'd be awesome. So where can people find you, get to know more about you? Where can they hunt you down?
So Instagram is definitely the best place. It's where I'm most active. I'm just at Jen Curtis Training. That's the best place. Everything leads from there. So I have certain resources that you can download, and then you'll get my emails. I'm pretty much Instagram and emails right now. That's the place to go.
For your own sanity, stay that way. Just like we tell our client, to concentrate on one thing. Yeah, do that. Awesome.
Yeah.
So ladies listening, Jen is awesome. I'm going to have her back, I promise. If you've enjoyed this episode, go follow Jen and share this episode, because I think it can help a ton of women and guys too, actually. And we'll see you on the next episode. Thanks for joining us, Jen.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Bye.